So, Marissa, how many weeks until the midterm elections?
Devin, there are 4 freaking weeks until the election. Are you ready to crush it?
I'm ready to crush it. Hi, I'm Devin Handy.
Hello, I'm Marissa Cavis.
And this is Crush the Midterms, where we talk about all of the things that you can do leading up to midterm elections to make sure we get Democrats elected. So it's been an exciting, I think we're on episode 6 now.
That's so crazy. What a journey.
I know. And this week's topic is very interesting, though often overlooked. We're going to be talking about polling and polling data and the never-ending stream of who's up, who's down, who's winning, who's losing, and sort of get an expert to tease out some of the nuance there.
People love polls. People love polling. I mean, a poll came out the other day, and you know that meme of Kermit with the hood on, like looking at himself in the mirror?
Yes.
And it's like me, but also me. And yes. So I was like, me, don't pay attention to the polls. Also me. Oh my God, I can't believe Beto's winning.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's really hard to figure out how seriously you should be taking these polls, because if it's in your favor, you really want to be like, yeah, this is totally affirmative. But then if it's not, you're like, well, polls are meaningless.
Right, exactly. Polls don't mean anything. Nothingmatters.com. It's also hard because a lot of times you'll get 2 polls that come out at the same time or very close to each other that have completely different outcomes, that have completely different people ahead. Marissa and I were just talking about polling out of Florida, and it's very contradictory. I mean, polls will come out that say one thing and then say another thing directly opposite just after. So right now the polls are saying that Andrew Gillum has a narrow lead in the governor's race
against DeSantis, who is crazy and racist.
But there's a poll from, you know, a couple of weeks ago that says Andrew Gillum had a 9-point lead. And so it's just going up and down.
And the same thing with the senatorial race in Florida. The current governor, Rick Scott, is running for Senate. And he has been, a couple of weeks ago, he had a nice lead. And then a week or so ago, Nelson was back up, and it just keeps fluctuating. And the same poll that just showed Gillum with a slight lead showed Scott with a slight lead. And then I looked at Real Clear Politics, which is, for those of you who aren't familiar, a great sort of central place to see all the different polls. It's like the average is Nelson up by 2.4 points. So he was up 7 at one point. He was up 1 at one point. And it's just like, you really, taking things with a grain of salt really applies to polling.
We talked to Rachel Bitticoffer, who is a professional pollster and political scientist who studies political behaviors. And what I really took away from our conversation was source of the poll is so important. And looking at the methodological information provided with the data can really give you an insight to how that poll will hold up in terms of you know, its accuracy.
And there are just so many different things to look at too. The sample size, if it's a small sample, you really can't put too much stock in it. So you could see a tweet about a poll that says, in Arizona, Kyrsten Sinema down by 5. But if you look at the sample size and it was, 400 people, there's, as Rachel put it, a lot of noise in a small sample, a lot of different variables that could really easily sway the final result. And so you really want to look at for large sample sizes. So you have to be, I would say, a responsible poll consumer.
Yes. And it definitely does take a little bit more research and a little bit more reading and analyzing to really get the most out of reading polls. And like you said, Marissa, though, there's this part of you that's like, take them with a grain of salt, take them with a grain of salt. And then it's Andrew Gillum's up. Woo! And it can be very emotional roller coaster, to be honest.
There's just not enough to be emotional about these days. So I'm really glad that we have polls to awaken our emotions.
to really give us that sense of panic in addition to all the other panic.
Sometimes I just look at polls to see if I still feel.
Honestly, that is exactly how it feels sometimes. And I know that a lot of us have some polling hangovers or a little bit of trauma after the 2016 election, because so many people said that, you know, Hillary had a clear lead and the polls showed her up almost the entire election cycle. And then obviously that never ended up coming to fruition. But I think something else Rachel points out is that, yes, the polls did show that, but she was saying that pollsters had signals that might not be entirely accurate because of the high number of undecided voters in those polls. And that's another thing to look out for. When you have undecided numbers in the teens, that poll might not be as reliable or as accurate as some others.
I just think that everyone's going to get a whole lot out of our conversation. And I hope it will help demystify this very seemingly complicated system, especially coming from someone like me who very narrowly passed statistics in college. I'm very impressed by the people who do this, and I appreciate what they do because it does have a big impact on the political discourse.
So it might seem tangential to crush the midterms, but looking at polling data is so important, and understanding what it means is really going to help you in the long run.
Okay, everyone. We are here with Rachel Bitticoffer, who is an assistant director of the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University. And she teaches classes about political behavior and campaigns and elections and political analysis. And we're so excited to have her here today because we are going to be talking about everyone's favorite topic, polling, the numbers. What do they mean? Thank you so much for joining us, Rachel.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a great topic.
It is.
It's fascinating. Yeah, I'm sure on Twitter every day we're seeing this poll just came out. And so I think we just kind of wanted to help our listeners demystify this whole process a little bit. So I wanted to start with a really basic question. When they say that polling is released, what exactly should we interpret that as meaning?
So when new polling is released, it means somebody has fielded a study and they have analyzed the data, weighted it to reflect the population they're trying to measure, which in the case of election polling isn't just, you know, citizens of the state of Virginia, it's voters in that universe, right? That's what you expect when you see a poll, is that you're, you know, going to get some evidence of what's going on in that election.
Okay, so I've always wondered, and I've never understood this. So when you say that they conducted a study or they took this poll, who is responding? Like, who are they? Who are you reaching out to? Who is responding? And how do you decide and craft a sample size and then kind of extrapolate?
That's a really great question. And the answer definitely depends on whether you're doing a horse race election poll or something involving public policy or something totally unrelated. But I'll speak specifically towards election polling because I think that's probably the most salient topic and the one that people are paying the most attention to. In terms of election polling, I think the best practice is to sample from the voter file, because you're going to keep in mind that for better or for worse in America, we have really, really low voter participation rates. And when we're looking at a cycle like 2018, we're talking about 40% of eligible voters voting. Okay. Right. So if my goal is to take a race and anticipate which candidate is ahead or behind, or if it's a tie or what, it really behooves me to be very careful on that front end sampling process, because I'm trying to get, you know, this subpopulation basically of citizen, the midterm election voter, right? So I think the best practice is using the voter file. And what that specifically is, and your listeners will be horrified to hear this, is a file that exists on every voter that includes, you know, some personal information, but obviously contact info for a cell phone, landline. It can contain which elections they vote in. If it's a state that has party registration, it would have that information. In fact, the private vendors that sell to campaigns have a lot more information in that voter file. But for the purposes of a poll, you know, we're looking to see, okay, who is a likely voter? Because that's my model if I want to be accurate on the horse race.
Right. That is horrifying.
It is horrifying. I think we've become probably a little too accustomed nowadays to knowing that just, you know, government companies have so much information about us. But I think it's interesting, you know, hearing that they have so much information on us, and yet it still can be really difficult to get super accurate polls. I feel like you see some polling about the same race and it's just swinging wildly one way or another. I know so many people are watching the Texas Senate race, and it's like one day you see Ted Cruz is up by 7, and then you see Beto O'Rourke is up by 2. So how do we look at those numbers and reconcile those in our brains as intelligent voters?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked that. I was hoping that I would get a chance to talk kind of about what Rachel Bitticoffer does when a survey is released. So the very first thing I do, you know, if you've got these surveys coming out on Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke, before I look at anything, really, I look at the end of the survey because I want to know what their methodology is. Specifically, I'm interested in how many respondents they have in the data. Because surveys, statistically speaking, get noisy when you're at 500 completes or below. So for me, if I see a 500 N size or less, I'm still going to look at it depending on how the rest of the design is done, but I'm going to be nervous about it, okay? Because I'm not going to be 100% confident in the veracity of the numbers because that N size is a little bit low. Ideally, you're talking about 700 or above, and really 1,000 is wonderful to have. And then the second thing I'm looking at is the sampling, like I talked about, the voter files, and that I think is becoming pretty standard now for these likely voter surveys. But there's still other ways that they're getting done, and if they're doing what we call RDD or random digit dialing sample, that's going to give me a little bit of pause too, because you're trusting respondents to tell you whether they're registered to vote. You don't know for sure whether they are or not, as you would with the voter file. And with the voter file, we sample out for our surveys. We're trying to get, you know, a really tight model and really accurately get the preferences of people who show up on election day, not just everybody. So one of the advantages with that voter history is I can say, okay, here's this, I've got 20,000 people and they do vote. Like I can see that they showed up in this election and that election and this election. And then from there, when I ask them, are you going to vote? And they tell me yes, then I know with some degree of confidence whether it's accurate or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So those are the two things that I'm most concerned about. I'm less concerned about whether it's online or on the telephone. I do want a mix of cell phones and landlines because you're going to underrepresent millennials and now front end of Gen Z if you don't have cell phone sampling. So, you know, I would say to your listeners, try to look for those things. If the survey doesn't have those things, then in terms of predicting an election, you might want to take whatever it's telling you with a grain of salt.
Right. So to that end, I've heard a couple of different places that, especially in these election polling data, that polls conducted before October or before the weeks leading up to an election are generally not useful in predicting election outcomes. Has that been your experience?
No, I don't necessarily think that's true. It certainly can be a problem because you have people who are tuning into the process late. Mm-hmm. And it seems so weird, but when I give my public lectures, I always tell the audience, hey, congratulations, you're in the 1%. And they always look around confused. And I'm like, no, not the economic 1%. You're in the information 1%, because you're here tonight doing this, lecture with a political scientist. And that means you're weird. We are a weird people. And when we are looking out at trying to make assumptions about other people based on what we know, then we're going to be wrong, because 95% of Americans are midterm. There's a midterm going on. And our environments really distort that, right? So I do think there is value in being closer to election day, obviously. I have some methodological tricks I use to get people off the fence if they say they're undecided. And you really do want to have a low number of undecideds, because this perception that the polling was really off in 2016 is actually not right. The data the whole time was sending a signal to us, and I'm saying us as in political scientists and journalists, that we were just not listening to. And that data point was the high, very unusually high number of people who were still saying they were undecided, even a week before this presidential election. Right. So, undecideds can make a big difference in a poll. If it's more than 10 points and you have a horse race that says it's 45 to 47%, really, you have not really a good picture of what's happening.
So interesting. So this time around, 2018, I know midterms are very different than a presidential, but are there any, are you seeing any signs like that the polling isn't that we should be kind of taking certain things from the current polling that's going on?
Yeah. So added to Rachel Bitticoffer's cheat sheet of what to look for in a poll, always look at that top line undecided. I have noticed quite a few of them are up in the teens. And so that's tough, because you're thinking, okay, well, this says it's 45%, 40, but I've got 13% of people in the survey of 500 that said they're undecided. So that means that I don't really have a very good sense of where this is going to shake out. I have a sense that at least it's not a landslide in one way or the other, but I'm not really getting a clear picture of who's going to win this very close race.
So is that what they say when you talk about margin of error, or is that just baked into the methodological process?
So that's another great question, and it wraps around to that N size. So literally what the margin of error is, and this is really always useful to have this conversation in the late fall, because we just went through hurricane season. And as you know, on the hurricane map, they have the picture of the hurricane, and then they send this cone out from it, and it's going to make landfall somewhere within that cone of uncertainty. Well, that's exactly what a margin of error is. It's a cone of uncertainty, and the size of that cone is going to be dependent on a few things about the survey, but is conditioned in a very major way on the number of completes that you have. So when you have a N size of 500 surveys, or I've seen a few in the 400s or even 300s this cycle, we're talking about a cone of uncertainty of 5-6%. And so a candidate might have 45% of the vote, or they might have 51% of the vote, or they might actually have 39% of the vote. Do you see how much uncertainty that introduces? So statistically speaking, when you have that low end size and a big margin of error, you really are introducing a lot of uncertainty. And then if you were to throw in a high number of undecideds on that, there's just a lot of uncertainty involved in interpreting that data.
I just saw earlier today that there are some new numbers out about the generic ballot for the midterms, and it looks like the Democrats have the largest margin they've had so far. And I wanted to, I would love for you to walk us through and our listeners through what is meant by the generic ballot, and how reliable is this sort of data?
That's wonderful. Yes. Yeah. So the generic ballot is a question that asks the respondent, if election for the House of Representatives or Congress was for today, would you vote for the Republican candidate or the Democratic candidate? And then based on that response, it gives one party the advantage, or if there's no advantage at all, it'd be a tie. So when we say that Democrats have been leading by 7 points on the generic ballot, that means there's a 7-point gap between preferences, right? And so it doesn't surprise me at all to hear that some new data is going to reaffirm this enthusiasm gap. There has been a lot of chatter and I think a lot of angsty hand-wringing going on in people since the Kavanaugh confirmation kind of went out of control and it was clear that he was going to be confirmed. And people have been like, oh, what have we done? We've activated the Republican base. But anybody that's familiar with my work on the Wasson Center blog will know that, you know, that is probably not going to be an issue. Instead, Democrats are going to have this big enthusiasm gap. And it's probably been made worse for Republicans, not better, having this Kavanaugh confirmation play out the way it did. Democrats were already basically a burning and a bonfire. And I think I've been referring to it now as an inferno of rage, right? So.
I definitely feel that. Yeah.
So with the surveys, you know, and this is the real limitation of them, is that you're basing what you, so there's a process we haven't spoken about on the tail end of data collection called weighting. And what that means is you have your data, and you have a natural shakeout of men and women and different races and ages and even regions or what have you. And it may or may not be a good natural reflection of the population, you know, voters in Virginia that you're trying to capture. So every survey will then apply back-end weighting to give some respondents more power in the data than others, so that it works out to reflect the actual population. And when we look at that weighting process, in general, pollsters are going to want to look at what has happened in the past and use that to make inferences about what the electorate will look like in the future. And that can be a real limitation. So let me kind of illustrate that with a story of our Virginia polling last year. I anticipated a big blue wave in Virginia of Trump backlash. And in my surveys, I was telling my colleague, look, I think Democrats are going to be super fired up. And I don't think the electorate's going to look like it did in 2014. I think it's going to be more favorable to certain groups that are democratically, especially college educated women. And so even though I've tried to kind of account for that in my weighting, we captured it within the margin of error, because the governor race here ended up being 6 points in favor of the Democrat, or 9 points in favor of the Democrat. And we called our polling was like steady, always at 6 or 7. I still feel like that weighting, I still underestimated that change. And I think that's probably what's happening in a lot of the polling this year. I think that surveyors are aware that there may be some changes in the demographic composition of the midterm electorate, that Democrats are going to improve in some areas, younger people, more college educated women or what have you. But I still think that they're underestimating just how much that improvement's going to be. So I think in races like Texas, if it's 5 points Cruz, to me, when I'm looking at that, I'm handicapping it up and saying, you know, this is probably almost a dead heat.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, that is really good to hear. It's also really fascinating. So I have sort of a psychological question, which might be outside the scope, but I feel like for a lot of people, polls and polling data are so comforting and people really respond, or comforting or enraging or worrying, and people really respond to this type of polling data. I mean, what is it about polls that makes us so emotional? I mean, if you look at it, it's just numbers. I'm the same way. Like, I take polls very seriously, but I've always wondered, like, is that been your experience? Is this something that like really means a lot to people?
Yeah, so I'm not a psychologist, but I do play one on podcast. So let me
tell you. So we'll allow it.
I am an expert in political behavior, and I like to say human behavior in general. So let me tell you why, because human beings hate ambiguity, and polls give us something tangible to hold on to. That's great, and it's really wonderful that the polling industry has just exploded since 2000. If you try to go back and get data like we have now, pre-2005 even, you'll see there's hardly any data out there like that. So we have this proliferation of polling, but the problem is that, you know, these methodological quirks can sometimes produce issues where people are expecting one outcome and they get another, and then they, that kind of, you know, makes them cast shade or throw shade at the polling industry in general. So I guess I would close that out by saying, you know, be a smart connoisseur. When we go to the grocery store, you know, you're looking to see, is this organic certified? Is it got GMOs? God forbid, you know, what we need to be like that about our polling data as well. And go to that methodology section, look and understand the limitations of the data, and then take from that data the amount of certainty it can afford you. And if it can't afford you a lot, then you need to wait for the next meal and order a filet mignon.
I had one last question from my end. I know that whoever's fielding the poll and the survey matters as far as the kind of outcome you're going to get, but it seems to me that the people interpreting the data is just as important. And before we got on, we were talking about how polling and it's a very male-dominated field. And I was wondering if you felt like you often saw differences in how you might interpret some polling data versus maybe a man looking at the same data.
Yes, I think so. I do think that there are some gender issues with that. I will say that, like, election polling is incredibly male dominated. Polling in the academic world is far more gendered and diverse. But in terms of the election polling, I definitely think that it can be an advantage to be coming from the female perspective. I think that our white male allies understand a little bit of the angst that has come into the American woman in the age of Trump. But they don't, although they may be able to sympathize with it, they aren't of it, if that makes sense. And so I think that there, yeah, it does, like, you know, I understand, I think, what's happening with women because I am a woman. And, you know, I think that it definitely matters to have, that's why you need to have diversity on, you know, these election panels, on these big ticket survey outfits. You know, you want to have a diverse group of people looking at the data, because it definitely does matter. Those decisions that you make about waiting in a horse race are absolutely as crucial as anything else that you decide. And you know, you need to be able to think about things as collectively and nuanced as possible. And that can be hard to do when you only have one one white guy on there.
Right. Well, there's such a focus on getting a diverse and representative group of people to poll. So the same consideration should be made for the people doing the polling.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, ultimately the, you know, when you said the firm's reputation matters, it does. And it comes down to that methodology, you know, so a survey that you can see and access the methodology, you can read it, you can get a pretty detailed description of how they collected the respondents and, you know, what they did with their weighting. Those are, you know, those are things that are going to happen with, you know, solid survey companies and academic outfits and, you know, the whole gambit. So, you know, this idea that I think people need to be cautious about survey data that they can't see much about the methodology for.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. So I have one last question on my end, and this has to do with how social media has affected polling. And if there's any time where you take maybe something like a Twitter trend into account. So if people are talking about something on Twitter, does that go into how you weight or look at something like traditional polling data? Because I know, especially in the 2016 presidential election, social media was such a central part of the story. So is that something that has kind of evolved with the polling industry?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Donald Trump is almost like an anomaly, though, right? So with Donald Trump, much of his communication to voters was through his Twitter account. And I know that we polled on topics that were related to things that he was doing on Twitter. But in terms of like a actual ongoing trend, I would say that in most cases, you're kind of locked in, right? It'd be hard to respond to a trend in real time through polling,
right.
That's done scientifically. Now, of course, when you have instant polls, usually you're doing that as an opt-in poll. Those are not what we call non-scientific polls. And a great example of them would be the instant polls that the media companies like to have on debates, right? Who's winning the debate? You know, let's watch it in real time. And keeping in mind that the people who are doing the survey are not being randomly selected because they are choosing to opt in. And who's going to opt in? Those people who are most passionate. So with social media, like real-time trend stuff, that could be a limit. So, if something happened big enough, and I guess anytime I can find a way to circle back to Kim Kardashian's butt photo, I always do. So when Kim Kardashian the field pretty quickly about that trend or that dress, remember with the blue dress, yep. Or is it white or is it blue? Things like that, that like really everybody's talking about. It's a water cooler level event. You could incorporate into survey research for sure.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for sitting down with us. This was honestly so fascinating because I didn't realize how much I didn't know about polling and how much I take for granted when I look at something like polling numbers. So it's been very helpful.
Well, I'm so glad. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. And we'll be watching your Twitter feed with bated breath as we get through these last few weeks. It's going to be craziness.
Yeah, please do. And don't be afraid to share my handle with your followers and push them to my site because I want some eyes on my midterm predictions. So.
Sure. Why don't you shout out your Twitter handle right now?
Oh, sure. It's at Rachel Bitticoffer. It was my first and last name. So it was totally available because no one wants to be a Bitticoffer. And then my survey or my midterm analysis and predictions, which are, by the way, totally awesome and completely different than what you're used to seeing, are available on my blog, which is the Wasson Center, if you Google that.
Awesome.
Awesome. Definitely will do. Well, thanks, Rachel. And stay strong these last few weeks.
you too.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
So, Marissa, that was such a fascinating conversation. Like we said at the top of the show, I feel like Rachel was just so clear and articulate and really illuminated a lot of these more complicated issues around something that is pretty complex, like polling. So what do you have for this week's call to action?
So your call to action, should you choose to accept it, which you better, is that we are now within 4 weeks of Election Day, which is so crazy and so soon and will go by in a flash. And so I and Devin want to challenge you to just go a little bit further, push yourself a little bit more, and sign up for one more activity that's going to help with a competitive campaign. So whether that's one more phone banking shift, one more canvassing shift, writing a few postcards to voters, text banking, which is another great and easy thing to do from home. You don't want to get to November 6th and feel like you didn't do all that you possibly could. So I really encourage you to take a look at your schedule. Don't overload yourself, but find an open evening or afternoon where you are going to write it down in your calendar, which as I get older and older, I realize is very important, putting it in your calendar. all about that calendar life. Put it in your calendar and block that time out and even set a reminder a few days before to make sure that you're all set.
And I guess I think the other call to action is to remember to take polls with a grain of salt. You can be excited about them, but know your sources. And I think that's also really important.
And maybe even go back and if you can think of a poll off the top of your head that you were really excited about or really bummed about, go take a little bit closer look through the lens of the things that Rachel told us and see if it's actually legitimate. And then you'll have like a cool little fact to share at a party if you're as cool as I am at parties.
I was going to say, I'm real fun at cocktail parties because I jump right into politics every time.
Oh my God. Yesterday, my friend and I played a game, and you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes for game, where we wanted to see how many U.S. senators we could name off the top of our head.
It's a lot. So,
yeah, I'm a hoot.
Yeah.
I got 43, and I was honestly pretty ashamed of myself because I missed some real layups.
Right. Oh, man. That's what you get when you're a politics nerd. So,
completely.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. We hope that you are enjoying this journey with us as much as we are. And so tune in next week for another topic, another guest, and another way to crush the midterms.
And if you haven't already, make sure all your friends and family know about crushthemidterms.org, where they can make a plan for volunteering and donating from now until the very imminent midterm election.
Yes. And then also, we want to hear your stories. So tell us on Twitter. You know, you can reach us and tell us how you are crushing the midterms, because it's so inspiring to see what you're doing every day.